Good afternoon and welcome to A Look at the Arts. I'm Tom Lounge, your host, and today my guest is author LaRue Agreste. She is the author of Boomer Tales, Hula Hoops, Hippies, Hemp, and Hijinks. It's a colorful reflection on coming of age during one of the most culturally and politically exciting eras of American history. It's a story of a Chicago girl growing up in the 50s and 60s and then disappearing off into the sunny Florida Keys. And she faces the different challenges that come with life, and she addresses it in the book, Boomer Tales. We're going to feature some great Boomer era music. We're going to talk to LaRue in just a minute, but as we get ready, let's set the mood.
Singers Lonnie Mack and Twang and Eddie Hisman ring, we're going steady. Take it easy, take me high, lie, lie. House of fire, no commotion, poker passion, deeper purple satisfaction. Baby, baby, got it, gimme, getting hotter. Sammy's cooking, Leslie Gore, Richie Valens, end of story. My Vista Fuji, I'm a Kamasutra, Rama Lama, Richard Perry, Spectre Barry, Rogers, Archers, Nielsen, Harry, Shimmy, Jimmy, Coco Poppin', Fats back and finger poppin'.
Life is a rock, but the radio told me. Gotta turn it up loud. DJ told me, ooh, ooh, life is a rock, but the radio told me, at the end of my rainbow, rock lies a golden oldie.
If a meme hits a clicking wall, the clock is talking, ticking, friends and Roman salutation, render in the tabulation, Carly Simon, the A-holder, Rolling Stone, and a folder, Johnny Cash and Johnny Rivers, casting now, I got the shivers, Mungo, Jerry, Peter, Paul, Apollo, Mary, Mary, Dr. John, the Nightly Tripper, Doris Day, and Jack the Ripper, got it, Ghost of Goddess, what a Leon Russell, give me Shell, the Miracles, and Smokey Blizzard, Sly Guitars, the Fender Bass, Mushroom Omelet, Bonnie Bramlett, Wilson Pickett, stop it, kick it.
Life is a rock, but the radio, life is a rock.
Jay and Dale and Ronnie, Kukla, Fran and Norman, Oakland, Denver, John and Osmond, Donnie, J.J. Kalen, ZZ Top and LLB, then D.D. Donna, David Bowie, Steely Dan, and Sing Me Proud of C.C. Ryder, Edgar Winter, Jordan Summers, Isaac Marshall, Johnny Thunder, Eric Clapton, Peter Wallace, Steve LaFosta, Doodah, Doodah, Cool Vibrations, L.B. Ronda, Surfing Girl, and Little Honda, Tida, Tida, Honey, Honey, Sugar, Sugar, Yummy, Yummy, CBS and Warner Brothers, RCA and all the others.
Life is a rock, but the radio rolling, gotta turn it up.
Told me, reaching and frolicking. Get it on and not too hardy, cackle hardy, hailing hardy.
Setting the mood as we take a trip back to the baby boomer generation. My guest today, book author LaRue Agresti. She is from Chicagoland. Her new book is Boomer Tales, Hula Hoops, Hippies, Hemp, and Hijinks. They all go together and they all kind of collided in about a 20-year period there. And we're going to cover that period and talk to her about what it was like growing up in Chicago and then the interesting, strange trip she's had through life. LaRue's had a variety of careers, including that of an accountant, a barber, a home decorator, which she's doing now, and of course, a bohemian in, I want to say, the 70s. Is that right, LaRue?
It's correct.
You've done so much.
I think, but the writing was always the first thing I wanted to do, and somehow or another, it full circled back, and and here I am.
You started writing as a child, correct?
Yeah, and I went through, you know, like really a writer's block thing because of my diary being read, and you know, I became paranoid to write anything down. Although when I was in the home building industry doing models, I wrote in trade publications. I would write, and it was kind of a way to keep my, you know, my writing chops up. And about 10 years ago, my sister Donna, who you know well, because you chronicled her career as a drummer,
right, here in Chicagoland.
Yes, and I am, you know, I kind of have a way of, you know, like you said, being a bohemian. I just throw everything out and move on, where Donna's more of a little pack rat. So, but thank goodness, because she kept every single letter that I had written her from the Florida Keys when I was in the hippie commune thing there. And about 10 years ago, she said to me, "You'll never guess what I found in a drawer." And so she sent them to me, and I started putting them in, you know, kind of a chronological order. And I found them to be a total time capsule. And all the hippie vernacular that I've forgotten was there. It was preserved. You know, I could have never recreated them.
Right. I was wondering, because chapter 14, Key Lime Pie, is pretty much just a chapter of your letters home.
And that's what, that's where the book started, in the middle, which, you know, it was funny because, you know, listening to, you know, some of your interviews, you know, with musicians and how, what the inspiration for a song was, and you just never know where it's going to start. When those letters came, it was the start of the book, and it kind of forced me to write in front of it and in back of it then, you know, in order for the letters to make sense.
Did you keep a journal or anything during those years that you also referred to besides the letters, or just from memory?
The other part of the book?
Right.
Done strictly from memory.
Wow.
It definitely was done from memory. And, you know, that you can put in your own words now with the vocabulary that you possess now, and that's what I did. But I could have never recreated those letters, you know what I mean, in the vernacular, and have it have that kind of authentic, you know what I mean, feel. They really inspired me to write around them.
Now, back then, you referred, from when you were living in Key West, you referred to Chicago as Bummer City. Now, of course, you're living back here in Illinois. Do you still find Chicagoland in the Midwest a bummer city?
You know, no. I really do love this area, and we do. In the last few years, we have a sailboat, and we do spend part of our time in the Caribbean. And I get most of my writing done there because there's less distractions, obviously, on a sailboat. But we do have family there too. We have children and grandchildren here and there. So there's deep ties here and family here, and I have a love of Chicago. And I think when you're younger, the grass is always greener somewhere else too.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
part of it.
How long was the creative process for you from the day those letters came and you sat down in the office with your Daryl dog next to you?
Yeah.
And then from the time you started it, that first word, to when it rolled off the press?
you know, I would say 10 years because I was so busy with, you know, you got to remember I was a model decorator when the housing market was in its crazy boom, you know. And
then after that, you found plenty of time to write, didn't you?
Well, you know, a lot of my, you know, and I tell people this because I encourage people to, you know, especially people in my age group now, because I consider us the tribal elders, to, you know, that there isn't any certain way to do it. A lot of my thoughts ended up on backs of gum wrappers while I was maybe waiting for my deposit slip to come through the bank. Drive up, you know, mm-hmm. And you have all these little scraps of papers and little thoughts, and pretty soon you start putting them in categories, and they turn into chapters. And the thoughts were being written down, and I think what happened was it's about, I would say, I got really, really serious about this about 4 years ago. And okay. Then it took about 2 years to really, you know, for all the chapters really to come together. And it's grueling, but if it's a labor of love, like, you know, I think I proofed my chapters 15 times myself, mm-hmm. and then sent them, you know, somewhere professional just to make sure that, you know, the punctuation was correct, because it's not my strong suit.
Okay.
So it was a process. It was definitely a process.
It's a personal story, and when you first start thinking, well, I'm going to read someone's personal story, you think, well, am I going to relate to it? But I think anyone that grew up in the era can relate to it. It's very loosely written.
Each chapter is kind of like its own little essay, you know, mm-hmm. kind of an essay form. And I just, you know, part of this is I just felt, you know, there's so many things that I would like to ask aunts and uncles and grandparents now that are gone, you know, and I'm sure I could see them more as humans if I, you know, I knew their story. And I, some of this is, as you know, is very raw, mm-hmm. And very honest. And it was, there were times when I would be sitting there going, can I really actually write this down? Because, you know, it's like your deepest, darkest secrets. But
right.
Then I realized if there was one person out there that read it and went, oh, my God, that happened to me, and I'm not alone in that, then it served a purpose. So a lot of it, is written with that Chicago droll humor, you know, too, because, you know, I am a Chicagoan. But I think that the characters, too, were important to tell, not just about myself, but about the characters that I witnessed growing up, because, you know, during the 50s and 60s, people were not as pasteurized, you know, they weren't as pasteurized, things weren't as politically correct,
mm-hmm.
and it was very colorful.
Well, many boomers became disenfranchised and rebelled against the quote-unquote wonderbread years, that stereotype and the status quo. You were certainly among them. You embraced that hippie culture of the late 60s, early 70s, the communal living, lots of music is mentioned in the book, a little bit of pot, hence the hemp title in there. And I found it interesting that you even had a big macaw that traveled with you.
Yeah.
I thought that was a fun character in your book.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to the macaw?
Big Bird ended up in Lincoln Park Zoo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he went to the aviary, you know, house there. So
is he still living?
So, that's a good question, because, you know, the macaws can live like,
exactly,
like 75 years. You know, they always say if you're going to get one, you better put them in the will, because they're definitely going to outlive you.
Now, what was it that made you leave Chicago? What was the turning point when you said, I've had enough of this, I need to get out and get on the road and do my Jack Kerouac thing?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, I had just been through a divorce, and I had a 2-year-old, and I was trying to make it on my own without child support. And I had, you know, my parents and my in-laws all, you know, up in my business. I just needed to get away. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, my ex and the father of my child, he was in another state. So I was bearing the brunt of, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. of everything. And I needed to go off on my own at this time. I really did. And, you know, when you're that age and you've never lived anywhere before, that's a big lure.
Right.
It's a, you know.
Especially if you're going to go somewhere warm after Chicago winters.
Yeah. Well, I had never, you know, if you think about it, I had only seen the ocean once. You know, I had been out to California. I had never seen the Atlantic,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and to live on a string of islands like the Keys, you know, it was an adventure too. It was more than just leaving Chicago, I think, and the in-laws. I think it was just, you know, the adventure of the whole thing. And I always encourage anybody who's not tied down now, you know, to, you know, take off, because someday you're going to be tethered down. You're going to have obligations, and you're going to have things that you're not always going to be able to do that. So you have to do it when you can.
Right. Well, we're gonna focus on Chicago right now and play something that's very boomer-ish from a hometown singer-songwriter, Dennis DeYoung. And this is a solo track simply called Boom Child. We'll be back with LaRue right after this. Boom Child Baby. Dennis DeYoung, I remember when that album first came out. That's the title track. And Dennis and I were having lunch at a place called Outriggers in Lansing. And we had a little cassette recorder. He played that. And I thought, man, that's a brilliant song. Should be in one of those old 80s movies. And sadly, it never really took off. But I think it identifies so many things that we all grew up with. LaRue, did you get a chance to listen to the lyrics on that?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And, you know, Chicago, you know, what I tried to do, too, is to bring in such of the rich characters and of, you know, growing up in Chicago and, you know, how your block was your universe, mm-hmm. hanging in the alleys and, yeah.
It's funny because we grew up and we actually did go outside and we played at railroad tracks and we went to the park and we didn't use our thumbs in the way they use them today and sit on the couch all day.
Yeah. Our parents, we were just talking about this the other day, is that we'd be gone all day long and they had no way to contact us and
yep.
We were just out until the streetlights came on.
Yep, you knew when to be home and not have your bottom beaten.
Exactly.
You know, talking about music, as I mentioned, you reference music a lot in the book. And for those that are just tuned in, we are talking about the Boomer Tales book, Hula Hoops, Hippies, Hemp, and Hijinks with LaRue Agresti. She is a Chicago author who has had so many journeys. And in the book, you write of listening, and I love it because you kind of put quotes around it, good tapes by Jethro Tull and Stevie Wonder and Carly Simon. And music was the soundtrack to so many of us, but it was the baby boomers, perhaps more than any generation, from the advent of rock and roll that made us dance to the message songs that made us reflect and think and strive for change. It really was a soundtrack to our lives. And how important was music to you? Obviously, we mentioned Donna is a professional drummer and did a lot of stuff in Chicagoland. Were you musically active?
You know, I'm not a musician, but I've been surrounded by musicians my whole life, and my sister being the first, you know, the first one. And I really, it's funny because now you have there's actually a series out called Soundtracks, and it, you know, and it's talking about how important the music is to the culture and to the events that happened. You know, they really, I think that the music defined us, you know, too. It defined our generation. And you really see that some of these songs are still so germane today,
mm-hmm.
because we're seeing some history repeat itself, and that they still, even though they define, you know, who we were and the social changes that were going on, that they're still germane today, and that, you know, they haven't lost their meaning. And in fact, in some ways, as time goes on, they become more germane.
Mm-hmm. Baby boomers, the term is almost generic at this point. It covers a large span of years. Each baby boomer is defined by the decade that we were born into. If we were born into the 50s, if we were born at the late 40s, if we were born in the 60s, each of us had different social mores, if you will. Is there one trait that you have found that bonds all of us as baby boomers?
You know, it's a good question because I'm getting a kind of a cross section of it because I'm actually right in the middle of the baby boomers. You know, I'm not in quite the older, you know, set of baby boomers, but yet, you know, not in the younger set. I'm in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really the baby boomers that were a year or two older than me. It's almost looks like a different generation. It really, and then the ones that are younger too, because, you know, their social experiences and everything were very, very different. You know, so I do think we're all like snowflakes. I think that there is a social consciousness, though, that runs through the whole boomer generation. I think that we were very socially conscious. And I think that that's probably a thread that runs through the whole boomer generation.
Now, I didn't realize that the Florida Keys were like a hippie haven. Of course, we always hear about the height in San Francisco. I was there a couple of years ago. And, of course, we had Old Town here in Chicago where the hippies congregated and Navy Pier back then. But I never realized that Key West was a hippie haven. I mean, I went there a few years back and everything's so high priced. How did the hippies survive?
Well, when we first got there, you were actually still allowed to legally camp out on a beach. And, of course, they changed that as they got inundated with all of us freaks.
Mm-hmm.
So that changed. But it was the lifestyle just was a lot looser there. And, you know, obviously we did have to live in a commune to be able to afford to live there because, you know, it was a tourist destination. And, you know, the housing, as I state in the letter, you know, it was very difficult for us to find, you know, some place to live, especially during high season. It was availability as well as cost. So we were kind of forced into this commune living just out of necessity. But it was a very, very loose environment there at the time. And even the native, you know, the native people there were very lax, very laid back. And it kind of was the anti-Chicago. It was, you know, you would just shop in your bathing suit or, a beach towel was work too, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very, very laid back atmosphere.
Now, I like the part in the book where you're talking about working at the fisheries and the smell of working with fish. That was not a very good way to escape. I mean, I think I'd rather be in Chicago than be knee deep in fish guts.
Yeah. Well, there was a, you know, there was a price to pay for paradise.
What was the hardest part of leaving Chicago and going on the road? I mean, obviously it was an adventure. You're excited, but there had to be some trepidation, some fear involved as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're going into the unknown, and I had no idea how long I would be gone. And I think that anytime you're going into the unknown, you have that apprehension. And I didn't know what to expect. You know, I was basically packing up and moving someplace that I had no idea what it even looked like or, you know. So, but you only do that when you're 23 years old.
Right.
You know, it's not something you would, you would do, if you had any sense, So, even though I was, let's put it this way, I was a parent and, I was a responsible as I could be being the age I was still 23.
Right.
And, thinking like a 23-year-old.
What did your family say? What did your folks say? I mean, you come from a pretty tight family. Then the Italian way is not to take off from the family.
Yeah. Well, I had already taken off from the family.
Okay.
Because of my situation at home with my mother, because she was never, mentally balanced. And I had, moved out when I was 18. The hardest part for me, and the letters are a testimony to that, the hardest part for me was being away from my sister, because my sister was really, we were almost like inseparable at that time. And that was why we even have this documented now. It was because of the bond between myself and my sister Donna that,
How many years difference is there?
There's 4 years.
Okay.
We're 4 years apart. I'm 4 years older.
Now, this book, and again, we're talking, if you're just tuned in, is Boomer Tales, Hula Hoops, Hippies, Hemp, and Hijinks. It's a story that has a lot of joy, a lot of exploration, a lot of laughter in it, but it's also tempered with a lot of pain and a lot of loss. You've lost some friends, you've lost family, you describe a lot of this. What was it like emotionally for you to relive so many different aspects of that?
Wow. Yeah, there were a lot of really emotional times. There were times, and then I actually state one of the times when I actually literally was on my hands and knees sobbing in my office when I was researching a chapter of what happened to my aunt, that, she was literally lobotomized because it was a common practice then to do.
Right.
Girls that were not socially fitting in or obeying the social norm. So there, it was an emotional trip. I can't say that it wasn't. And it's like I said, there were other times when I sat there and said, can I really write this down? And I had read something way back when about writing that stuck with me. You know how you'll read a million things in your life and you'll have a few things. It's just like things that happen to you that stick with you. And one of the things that stuck with me was that if you're going to write and you're not writing fiction, if you're writing nonfiction, if you don't write the truth, you're pretty worthless. And I really took that to heart and went, I just have to be truthful whether it makes me look good, bad, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I was reading certain parts, I was thinking the same thing. I was like, wow, that really took effort to have to put that kind of stuff together and relive that and recall it in the detail you do. It was like therapeutic, maybe.
Yeah.
It's a great read. We empathize with you in the book. You were able to capture that and make us feel what you were going through.
You know, I know that for a lot of people in my generation, they may have gone through a lot of these different things that I write about. And it's like I said, if it's one person can go, oh, my God, I've been through that, too, mm-hmm. and feel better. And, you know, the other thing that I've found is that people of my daughter's generation, the Generation Xers, they've really been really excited about the book. And they've been the ones going, when's the second one coming? Because they relate, because they have so many of these same experiences with their parents. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of, it was a little bit nostalgic for them. And then I find, like, you know, the younger generation are kind of living vicariously. You know, there's kind of like a little resurgence to the hippie thing with the younger generation. I know it is with my grandson, who's in his 20s. And they're kind of curious about it, but not just that. It's almost like they can live vicariously by reading this. Because let's face it, it was a much more carefree time, mm-hmm. you know, when, you know, it was a much more carefree time and a more innocent time when it came to sex and drugs. And, you know, it just, you know, it was a really golden time where we were kind of real innocent. I think that that's the thing. When we were doing all this stuff, we were wide-eyed and experimental and, it hadn't gotten to be where it was, you know, dangerous and life-threatening, you know, the whole free love thing. And also, the drugs hadn't gotten to the scale of, you know, a big cartel. It was a different time.
Right, right. Yeah, the drugs today compared to then are toxic.
Exactly.
You know, it's unbelievable, the difference. You know, people growing up today think, oh, well, the hippies smoke pot. Well, it's not the hydroponic stuff that the kids have today, the medical stuff. I mean, that the potency is incredible on that compared to, not that I would know, of course, but read.
You know, the chemicals
right.
that exist now, is a lot of synthetic things, it's very deadly. And it's not, there's nothing innocent about what's going on now.
You know? Right.
Not a thing innocent about how, you know, what it's manifested in.
What regrets do you have, if any, of the life that you led that now you have come full circle in many ways?
Yeah, you know, I guess, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda. And I think that, you know, would I have liked to have given my daughter maybe, you know, more stability? Sure. And, I had, a lot of personal ups and downs with relationships. But, you know, I think that everything that I have ever been through, it's never, ever happened to me yet that I didn't run into somebody else that was going through the same thing. And I'm like, aha, that's why that happened to me, because I have empathy now. Because mm-hmm. I don't really think you can understand something until you've actually lived through it. You might think you understand it. Mm-hmm. And I think, has it made me better? Yeah, you know. And I think that my daughter has to see me, warts and all. We're best friends now. And, I mean, there's rarely a day that goes by that we don't speak half a dozen times and see each other. But one of the reasons I did this, and I encourage other baby boomers to do this, is because I want my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, when they're old enough to read this.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right. Because it is a little rough.
Yeah. To know that I was a real person, you know, and that I was flawed, and, you know, and that it was a growth experience, and that their life doesn't have to be, you know, life is messy.
Right.
And, you know, and if you're writing about a real, true life, I mean, there's people that can sail through life without having, you know, probably one-eighth of what happened to me happened to them. It was funny because when you start reading your reviews, which is always a bad thing to do, but mm-hmm. the one that got me the most was a review that said, boy, this is a strange book about a strange life. But I finished it and enjoyed it, you know. And you know, I think that but it's real. That's the thing. It might not have been perfect. I think you can't. I think I wouldn't be where I am now. So I guess it's hard to regret anything.
Okay, let's play one more tune, and then we'll be back final time with LaRue.
Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, George. FDR, Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc. Roy Khan, Wamparon, Toscanini, Dacron, Dien Bien, Foo Falls, rock around the clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's got a winning team. Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Princess Grace, Peyton Grace, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Another song the baby boomers can certainly relate to, Billy Joel, We Didn't Start the Fire, and we are talking about baby boomers and boomer tales and hula hoops and hemp and hippies and hijinks, and we're talking with LaRue Agresti. She is the author of that book, and LaRue, this was self-published, correct?
Correct, yes.
Was there a reason you went that way, or was it just easier to do?
Well, I did a lot of research, and what happens with, you know, when you try to go through the traditional publishing, route is that you have to find, first of all, an agent that wants to take you. And then, you know, there's no guarantee that they will get you, you know, into a publishing house. And even if they can, you're expected to pretty much, you know, self-promote and do your own marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And it can just take years. Even if you're lucky enough to land a book deal, it could take years. And I just thought, I'm just going to go for it. You know, I've put this much time into it. I went through, the arm of Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very easy and professional process. I have to say it was probably the least intimidating thing that I had to do, book marketing,
right.
A little more intimidating, but the process was very, very professional. They had all the professional services there and they made it very easy. So I have to say it was the right choice, for me anyway.
How has it been selling? You mentioned you've gotten a fair amount of reviews, and I went online, and it seems like there is a lot of buzz about the book out there,
yes.
Which is unique for a self-published book from a new author, so to speak. How's it done? Are you surprised?
It's done really well. I just released a few months ago the audio version, and that was a journey in itself because, you know, I had to audition voices because I really thought it would be better to have it done professionally rather than have me read it. And it was very hard to find somebody that had that Chicago sound to them, mm-hmm. you know, and I did. And so it's the audio version just came out. The Kindle version has done very, very well, and the audio seems to be picking up. So the audiobooks have gotten to be very big now. So I thought it was important, you know, to do that. There's a lot of people that are stuck in our Chicago traffic, and right. you know, that they can't, you know, they can be entertained and have a book read to them while they're commuting.
Or they sit on the South Shore, the Amtrak on their way into the city, and then it gives them something to do.
Yeah.
What kind of feedback did you get from Donna? She plays a big part in this book. What was her feedback to you when it came out?
You know, she had, I mean, her husband, Owen, I'm sure maybe you're familiar with him. He's an English major and a very good writer himself. And he was actually one of my first editors.
Ah.
And I gave I gave my first text to him before I even did my 15 edits. And, you know, let him go through it for me and kind of make suggestions. Mostly it was just, why don't you expound a little more here? Why don't you explain this a little more there? You know, because when you're so close to something, you know, it's hard to be objective. It
right.
really is. And so, yeah. So she knows that she was responsible for it. As like I said, she was really, her keeping those letters was the inspiration that started the whole thing. It was the spark.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from your daughter? And what's her take now on the life that you led when she was so young? And obviously she has some great memories and maybe some a different kind of childhood memory.
Yeah, she does. And, you know, I've always been honest with her all the way, you know, from, you know, she watched me grow up as well as I watched her mm-hmm. grow up. You know, it's because, you know, I was so young. And I've always been honest with her, so it didn't surprise her, the honesty that was in the book. And she has been probably my biggest cheerleader. And her friends are, you know, have been the so excited about reading it. And like I said, it's mostly her friends that are going, well, when's the next one coming out?
Mm-hmm. Did she give you any feedback when she hit adulthood and teenhood and adolescence about the kind of life you guys had led?
We've always been close, and I have to say, you know, we were just best friends. And you know, other than a couple of times in the teen years, you know, where you get the "I hate you,"
right?
You know, but other than that, we've just always been, you know, best friends, and that's pretty normal. If that doesn't happen, there's something wrong with your kid because they need to separate themselves from you at some point,
right?
And that's part of the process. But and it seems that every year we just get closer and closer. I mean, we are truly best friends. And if anything, the years have just made us closer. And because she was there and went through all of that, and, you know, no matter what was going on, it was always her and I together. And we were like one unit. And it was just always a very, very close relationship. So I guess, I don't know. I think you'd have to ask her if she would, you know, if she would have wanted to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I think that it's important to be honest with your kids because, you know, they have to understand that their life is not going to be perfect either.
Right.
They can't, if you set them up to expect this perfection or you set yourself up as this icon of perfection, I think you're doing them harm. I really do. Because that life, this is the piece of advice I gave my daughter when she was in her early 20s. I said to her, you know, honey, life is everything happening to you that you don't think is ever going to happen to you. And that's the best advice I could give you. Other than the male and female brain are different, and as soon as you understand that, it's easier. That was my other advice. So
there's two things I do want to touch on, and one is the cover art. I mean, it makes you want to buy the book. You look at the cover and you know what it's about. I mean, I think it's a great cover. It reminds me of the classic albums when you go to a record store. For those of us that remember those, the album cover often made you buy the music.
Yeah.
Who did your art? Because I don't see credit on the book.
Well,
I've got.
It was CreateSpace, and I have to really, really give them credit because I gave them explicit instructions. I told them I wanted it to look like a 1960s Art Nouveau block poster. I told them I wanted the peace sign, you know, in the O.
Mm-hmm.
I told them what colors I wanted. It was a female artist. She got it on the first. I was so prepared to go, no, next, change this, tweak that. They got it on the first take.
It's brilliant.
I was just like bowed over when I really was when I got the image. I was because apparently she was listening.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It reminds me of something that, you know, like a Donovan album or a George Harrison album or something.
Yeah.
It's very hippie-esque.
Yeah.
And tells you what's there. The other thing is that the only disappointment I had was the fact that you didn't have any photos in it.
That was my daughter's comment, too. It's so funny that she thought that there should have been photos because we do have them. And I'll tell you why I didn't. It's because usually, usually you see photos with biographies of like celebrities, and I thought, well, who the heck am I that I'm going to put my pictures in the book? You know, so it might have been, you know, in retrospect, you know, maybe it would have really added something. But at the time, I kind of thought, I thought it might be, I don't know, too egotistical.
I mean, you do paint a lot of pictures with your words, but I was just trying to visualize who some of these characters were. You know, as you're talking about them, you're describing them. It's like, you know, let's see a picture. What does that guy look like? What does that person look like? Or, you know, maybe some shots of your daughter growing up in this lifestyle in the pages. And I just think it would have enhanced it, and maybe volume two. Is there a volume two coming?
I've been working on it, and that's definitely in the works.
Because you kind of skated past the disco type era,
latter. Yeah, well, it kind of ended in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I had a Kirkus review done, and he totally got it because when he reviewed it, he goes, oh, and I can't wait for the next book because some of the comments I've gotten is, well, like, where's the rest of the story? Well, the rest of the story is the second book.
Right. Okay. Very good.
It's called Don't Spill Your Candy in the Lobby. You know? And I just didn't want the first book to get too long and too arduous. And, you know, so, and I really already had a lot of notes for the second book by the time I was done with the first book.
Well, this is an easy read, and I look forward to the second book coming out. Do you have a timetable?
I'm hoping within the next year.
Well, definitely reach out to me and let me know, because I want to see how the story works itself out.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
All right. Like most boomers, we were all raised with a sense of family, and you came home and you took care of your family, and you're in the, I don't want to say golden years of your life, because we're all living so much longer, but you're at a point in your life where you get to look back and reflect and share that with us. And as Jerry said, what a long, strange trip it's been. LaRue Agresti, thank you so much. Is there a website where we can keep up with you at?
www.larubooks.com. And there's a Facebook page for Boomer Tales.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, it's been groovy.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in. Keep trucking like the doodah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on, on.
Flashing marquees out on Main Street, Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. A typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings.
Dallas got a soft machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans. New York got the ways and means and just won't let you be.
The cats that you meet on the streets speak of true love. Most of the time they're sitting and crying at home. One of these days they know they gotta get going, out of the door and down to the street all alone.
Chugging like the doodah man once told me, you got to pay your hand. Sometimes the cards ain't worth a damn if you don't lay them down. Other times I can barely see. Lately it occurs to me, what a long, strange trip it's been.
What in the world became a sweet Jane? She lost her sparkle, you know she isn't the same. Living on Reds, vitamin C and cocaine, all a friend can say is ain't it a shame.
Trucking up to Buffalo, been thinking you got to mellow slow. It takes time to pick a place to go. Just keep trucking on home.
Staring out of the hotel window, got a tip they're gonna kick the door in again. I'd like to get some sleep before I travel, but if you got a warrant, I guess you're gonna come in.
Busted down on Bourbon Street, sit up like a bowling pin. Knocked down, it gets to wearing thin. It just won't let you be.
Like a trap.